we're going to talk about the key things you must know to survive, let alone succeed as a real estate investor. Over the last 15 years, I have been a real estate agent and broker, and I have bought, sold, developed, and leased over $50 million worth of real estate in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Now, I don't claim to be an expert yet, but I have bought, built, rented, leased, and sold residential, commercial, and industrial properties. I have made a lot of money for myself and others, and I hate to admit I've lost money making foolish decisions. I've also lost money making what appeared to be prudent decisions, but I got caught when economic conditions changed unexpectedly. Now, there's probably no area where more myths prevail about wealth and success than in the field of real estate. You'll hear people saying that 90% of all fortunes in America come from real estate, that they aren't making any more of it, that it's the surest route to financial independence for the average person, and that you can buy it with no money out of your own pocket and have your tenants pay it off for you. Now, these assertions are partially true and partially false. The field of real estate is one of the most dynamic and competitive in the country, and the real estate industry includes some of the smartest, sharpest, most experienced business professionals anywhere. And every year, even in boom markets, these people, the experts, lose millions of dollars as a result of decisions and investments that turn out wrong. One of the great truths of business and of life is that there is no such thing as a free lunch. There is no such thing as easy money. Nowhere in this course have we said that it was easy to achieve financial success, and this is equally, if not doubly true, in real estate. Yes, it is possible to do well in real estate if you approach it as you would any other business. Here are five key requirements for success in the field of real estate. First, set out clear, specific goals and put timelines on them. Second, write out a detailed plan of action organized by priority. Third, learn every detail of the business, as we'll talk about in a minute. Fourth, be prepared to back your plans with hard work, sacrifice, and persistence. And finally, number five, resolve to get in for the long term. I worked for several years with a brilliant investor and entrepreneur who accumulated over $500 million in real estate starting from nothing over the course of his career. He taught me many valuable lessons about real estate, which I'm going to pass on to you in this cassette, plus a lot more besides. Every time I ignored his lessons, I ran into trouble, and every time I followed them, I was successful. None of his advice was more important than the necessity for patience and a careful examination of every detail of the property before making a commitment. So let's begin with a definition of real estate in its simplest terms. Here it is. Real estate is its future earning power. Let me repeat that. Real estate is its future earning power. The value of any piece of property is determined by the income that can be generated by that property when it is developed to its highest and best use from this moment in time onward into the future. There are millions of acres of land throughout the U.S. that will never have any real value, like desert land, for instance, that cannot be developed to produce income or to satisfy specific human needs. There are vast areas of many large cities where property values are declining because growth and development have come and gone and will probably not return. Every day, men and women are selling homes and properties at less than they paid for them or are losing them to foreclosure because these properties have declined in earning power and therefore in value. If you sincerely desire to enter the real estate field, to purchase property as an owner and investor, the simplest way to start is by using what is called the Nickerson method, or buy 'em, fix 'em. That means buy them and fix them up. William Nickerson is a real estate investor who started with almost nothing and built a vast fortune using a simple formula that has since worked for thousands of people. It's described more fully in his book, How I Turned $1,000 into $3 Million in Real Estate in My Spare Time, but here I will give you the key points of the system. There are several steps for you to follow. Step one, you do your market research and you look at houses until you find one that is underpriced relative to the neighborhood because it is run down and needs a lot of work. Real estate agents call this type of house a handyman special, and sometimes they advertise it like that in the paper, or sometimes they advertise it as needing TLC, tender loving care. For you, it is a sleeper. It's more valuable than it appears. Step two, you purchase the house with the lowest possible cash down payment, getting the seller to carry back a second mortgage or trust deed on the property. Step three, you move in and begin working evenings and weekends to renovate and refurbish the house, doing all the work yourself. Step four, when you have transformed the house and the yard through hard work, you can do one of three things. You can, one, sell the house for more than you paid. take the profit and buy another house to refurbish and renovate. Or two, you can rent out the house at a rate that covers your mortgage payments and that perhaps gives you extra cash flow. Or three, you can rent out the renovated house and then go to the bank and refinance the house, often for as much as you paid for it, based on the new earning power of the property when rented out to a tenant, and a new higher appraisal of the property's value, which the bank will require. Step 5. You can repeat the process with another, perhaps larger house, investing your sweat equity or human capital in the renovations until you have fixed that up and are ready to either sell, rent, or refinance once again. And step 6. As you increase your assets, your cash flow, and your experience, you can move up to duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, and eventually apartment buildings, which we'll talk about later. Many of the great real estate fortunes in America have started off with an individual purchasing one house and going to work to fix it up, then selling the house, getting another, going to work to fix that up, and eventually it's turned into a real estate empire, which in some cases embraces thousands of residential units. Now, the two main advantages of this Nickerson method are, number one, you can do it while you keep your full-time job, continuing to generate cash flow from your job for repairs and renovations. And two, you can start small with little or no money, little or no risk, and grow as you gain knowledge and experience. Remember, buying them and fixing them is the same as starting a business. If you start small and bootstrap or grow out of your own efforts, you're much more likely to be successful and you have a very, very short distance to fall. It's very unlikely that you'll go broke doing this. Now let's talk about what is called buying real estate with no money down. There's no question but that it is possible to buy real estate, especially older homes, with no money down. That's true. What this means is that the purchaser finds someone who is eager to sell his or her house and who is therefore willing to carry back a second mortgage or a trust deed on the property. It's the only way to get real estate with no money down. For example, a house is for sale for $100,000 and the purchaser can get an 80% mortgage on the property. Let's say you are the purchaser. If the seller will carry back a $20,000 second mortgage, you, the purchaser, could end up owning the house, subject to the mortgages, with no money out of your own pocket. In other words, the bank would put up $80,000 for a first mortgage, the seller would take back $20,000, you have a $100,000 house that you owe $100,000 for, but you haven't put any money out of your own pocket. If you, the purchaser, could then turn around and rent the house for an amount high enough to cover both mortgage payments and taxes, the renter would eventually pay off the cost of the house, and the purchaser, yourself, would own it with no money down. This requires a rental rate equal to approximately 1% of the purchase price per month, and we'll come back to that later. Alternately, you, the purchaser, could move into the house, make the payments while fixing up the house, and then either resell the house or rent it for enough to earn a profit, or refinance the house based on its new cash flow from a tenant, as we talked about earlier. The dangers, or the pitfalls, in this system of buying houses with no money down are basically as follows. First, if the house is priced reasonably in a normal housing market, the sellers won't have to accept no money down. They can get cash to mortgage or they can refinance the house themselves. Second, you, the purchaser, must have sufficient income to make the payments on both mortgages or the seller will have the right to foreclose and to take the house back. Or third, if the purchaser rents the house out to a tenant, that's if you rent the house out to the tenant had better be able to pay the rent or the purchaser will have to come up with it or lose the house. So there's a lot of pitfalls in buying homes with no money down, and many people have lost their shirts because they've been able to get into a house with no money down, but they haven't been able to carry it and to make the payments. Also, the renter must not do anything to damage the property or the value of the property will decline and the purchaser will end up owing more than the house is worth. And let me tell you, renters do damage rental property. Sometimes renters destroy rental property. So if you decide to embark on this voyage of real estate investment, you must take considerable care and do some thoughtful analysis in making your investment decisions. Here are some of the things that you will have to learn in order to make money in real estate. Number one is you'll have to study the economics of the city and the economics of the neighborhood where you're thinking of investing. Look at the neighborhood as though it were a company and look at a house in that neighborhood as though it were a share of stock in that company. Some cities and some neighborhoods are in a state of decline and are risky choices for real estate speculation. These are primarily the places where you can get homes with no money down. Other cities and other neighborhoods are growing and are good choices for investment. Number two, you'll have to learn the various factors that make a property valuable in a specific area, and we'll talk about those as we go along. Number three, you'll have to learn how to evaluate and appraise real estate in order to determine what kind of a price you can afford to pay. And again, we'll talk about that later on in this tape. And number four, you'll have to learn how to negotiate and how to sell people on the idea of dealing with you, on giving you terms, on selling you their property. Let's start with urban or city economics. What makes a city a good bet or a poor bet for real estate investment? There are 10 factors to consider in choosing a city in which you intend to invest in real estate. Number one, obviously, is the general level of business activity in the nation. Nationwide recessions and depressions hurt all real estate values everywhere, but nationwide booms do not necessarily help all real estate values. Number two, you have to look at the level of local business activity, and the most important indicator is the number of new business startups and the growth in employment in the area. Fortune magazine has concluded that you need 3-4% new businesses every year just to maintain the same level of employment. In other words, if an economy has 1,000 businesses registered with the city hall, it needs to be adding 30 or 40 new businesses per year just to stay even. A growth rate of new businesses in excess of 3-4% is a good indicator of growth and growth in employment. The third thing you have to look at is the changes in the unemployment and the income sources for the community. Is industry moving in or out? Are there government offices moving in or out? Where are the jobs coming from? Where are the jobs going to? The fourth thing you have to look at in investing in any city is the trends in financing terms and interest rates in the area. Are they going up or down? Are the interest rates higher or lower than the national averages? How much will you have to pay down to buy a home in that particular area? What kind of terms can you get? What kind of interest rate will you have to pay on mortgage financing? Number five, you have to look at the rate of population growth or decline. Now, here's a very important formula. Real estate prices increase at twice the rate of population growth and or three times the rate of inflation. Now, what does that mean? It means if there was no inflation, but population was growing 3% per year, real estate prices would grow at twice 3% or 6% per year. If population wasn't growing, but inflation was growing at 3% per year, home prices would increase at three times that, or 9% per year. But let's say you have 3% population growth and 3% inflation. That'd be a total of 6% plus 9%, which would give you a 15% increase or upward pressure on real estate prices, especially home prices, in any given 12-month period. So look at population growth or decline. Also, if population is going down, real estate values will decline at twice that rate. If it's losing 2% population per annum, real estate values will decline at 4%. Number six, you have to look at the changes in the taste and preferences of home buyers. What kind of homes do people want now? What kind of homes will they want in the future? How does that compare with the homes that are for sale now? Many homes are built in a style that is outdated. People don't want to live in that type of house, and it's very important that you don't invest in them, no matter what the price is. Number seven, you have to look at the volume of building activity and construction cost levels and trends. How many new homes are being built each year relative to the rate of absorption? In other words, if they need 1,000 new houses per year and they're building 1,000 new houses per year, you'll have very little upward pressure on housing prices. For example, in Phoenix, Arizona, in what is called the Valley of the Sun, it's as flat as a tabletop. As fast as people need new homes, they build entire new subdivisions of homes, so home prices in Phoenix have remained flat for years because there's no upward pressure that can't be satisfied by the existing construction market. The eighth factor you have to consider is the vacancy rate. It's perhaps the most important single factor influencing real estate market trends and values. The basic rule is that a vacancy rate below 5% in rental accommodation is good and it causes upward pressure on home prices. A vacancy rate above 10% is poor and causes downward pressure on home prices. And a vacancy rate somewhere in between is something that you have to use your judgment on. A ninth factor is the interrelationships between prices, rents, and construction costs. These are important to market conditions. For instance, wide differences between listing prices and final sales prices are especially significant. 85-90% is common. Let me tell you what I mean. If a house is listed for $100,000, and homes listing for $100,000 are selling for $75,000 or $80,000, it means that there's downward pressure on home prices. If homes listing for $100,000 are selling at $95,000 and $98,000 and at full price, it means there's probably upward pressure on home prices. So look at the disparity between listing prices and final sale prices. And the 10th factor to consider in investing in any city is the volume of market activity, which is reflected in the number of deeds recorded, the numbers of mortgages recorded, and the volume of foreclosures. Where do you get this information? You go down to City Hall, and you go down to your Chamber of Commerce, and you ask them for these statistics and figures on activity within the local community. The key is to compare present levels of home building, renting, and sale activity with past levels to see if the market is getting better or if the market is getting worse. The average selling time for houses in certain price ranges is also important information. For instance, in some markets, a house selling for $150,000 will sell in an average of a week or two. A house selling for $500,000 may take 5 to 8 months to sell. A house selling for $1 million may take 2 years. So when you're thinking of investing in a home, it's important that you look at how fast the home in that price range is turning over so you know how fast you can sell the house should you take it back to the market. The most important single factor in determining whether you invest in any city or any area is the number of productive jobs in the area and the wage levels for those jobs. Let me say that again. The most important single factor in determining real estate values is the number of productive jobs in the area and the wage levels for those jobs. People pay for homes in direct proportion to how close they are to where they work. People buy the very most house that they can qualify for in terms of a mortgage, and they buy it as close as they can to where they work and shop and go to school. When jobs increase, or wage levels increase, or interest rates go down, housing prices and demand for housing goes up. For instance, in a city like Houston, where wage levels have gone down and population has gone down, the prices of homes have been flat for many years. In places like San Diego or Los Angeles, there is an influx of new people. There's upward pressure and continued upward pressure on home values. Cities can be classified into 5 types based on their major sources of employment and income. And again, in deciding what city you want to live and work and invest in, these are very important considerations. The first kind of cities are what are called industrial cities. Industrial cities are primarily in the Northeast. Industrial cities are based on the manufacture and processing of commodities, steel, coal, raw materials. Cities like Detroit and Baltimore and Pittsburgh. When the national economy is strong, these cities do well with jobs and wages, and real estate prices are stable. The second type is cities devoted primarily to commerce, which includes seaports, lake ports, river cities, and railroad terminals, for instance, like Chicago, Los Angeles, San Diego, Miami. These cities have more stable economies because they are always busy with the transshipment of goods and services. The third type of city, one of the best types of city to invest in, is political cities. State capitals, Washington, D.C., they have stable workforces, they have stable economic bases. As you've probably noticed, governments very seldom decline in the rates of employment, so there's steady employment, steady wage levels in political cities. The fourth type of city is what is called recreation and health resorts, which are retirement centers or vacation centers. Now, these places have seasonal economies, and they're always the first places to be affected by recessions. When times are booming, these places do well. When times are poor, these places do terribly. A decline in discretionary income or income available for investment or holidays or vacations always affects the vacation places first. Examples are Aspen, Colorado, or Park City, Utah, or Maui in Hawaii. These places do wonderfully well when the economy is strong, but when the economy turns down, they're terrible places to have investments. Now, the fifth type of city that you can invest in, and perhaps one of the best of all, is a city that is an educational, research, or cultural center. For instance, Austin, Texas has the University of Texas, and San Jose, California has Berkeley and Stanford. These places are some of the hottest places to invest because these are, in many cases, the fastest growing cities in the United States. They usually have very stable, very strong economies because they attract new businesses and, in most cases, new high-tech, highly intelligent businesses that require white-collar workers and very well-paid people. Here are some of the factors that give a city the power to grow. First is economic and political power that can be used to attract new business and industry. There must be reasons for businesses to move there, to start up, to invest, to expand, and to increase their employment. A second factor that gives the city the power to grow are dynamic community leaders, politicians, and entrepreneurs, a pro-development mentality, pro-business, pro-free enterprise. In any city or area where they are anti-development, you know that you're going to be taking a risk if you invest in property in that area. The third factor that gives a city the power to grow is a pool of labor, especially an educated professional labor force. In many respects, the number of educated professional white-collar people in an area is what makes it attractive for businesses to locate in that area. And it's always determined by the number of colleges and the universities in the city or area relative to the general population. Boston, for instance, for many years was one of the fastest growing cities in the U.S. because of all the universities in Boston. It has more universities and colleges per capita than any other major city. The fourth factor that gives a city the power to grow is the ability to export more goods and services out of the area than are imported into the area. This is called the ability to command income from beyond its borders or city limits. We would call it a positive balance of payments. In other words, a city or a geographical area that exports a lot of goods and services to other parts of the country and therefore brings in money is always a good place to invest. The fifth factor is the ability to attract or generate new sources of income and employment. And as we said earlier, new business formation. The number one variable that determines whether an area is going to grow in real estate values is the number of new businesses that are being formed in each 12-month period. The average community loses 8 to 10% of its jobs by natural attrition each year. These plus more must be made up by growth and development. So it requires new business development at a rate of 5 to 8% just to make up for the jobs that are being lost every year. The sixth factor is the quality of living conditions, and you can't underestimate this. The lifestyle, the weather, the quality of local government, the levels of taxation, even the environmental conditions like the amount of sunshine or the amount of rain each year, and other competitive factors, they all contribute to or detract from a city. That's why cities like San Diego, San Antonio, Tampa, Miami, Orlando are so popular because they're warm and many people from cold parts of the country find them attractive. It's one of the reasons why the Sun Belt is growing in population and why the Rust Belt is losing population. People want to live where it's warm and sunny, where there's excellent environmental conditions. And this affects real estate values and real estate opportunities. You can make more progress in 5 years in a dynamic, growing city than you can in 20 years in a dying city, or even a city that is leveled off, like Chicago or Milwaukee. Here are some things to remember in looking at buying a house anywhere. First, each property is unique. It's unlike any other. It's immovable. It occupies a particular spot on the earth's surface. The three key factors in purchasing real estate have always been location, location, location. A second point is that some owners have a sentimental attachment to their properties and their ideas of value are distorted by their emotions. Homes are very emotional possessions. In a neighborhood I lived in a couple of years ago, there were two brothers. One lived up the street and the other one lived down the street. The one who lived down the street had a beautiful, beautiful home and sold it for $250,000. The one who lived up the street had an average home, and he put it on the market also for $250,000, and it sat on the market for more than 2 years before they finally sold it for $150,000. But the brother was absolutely determined that he should get the same amount for his house that his other brother had gotten for a far more valuable house. You can't win a bidding contest with a person who is emotionally attached to their home and feels that it's worth far more than it really is. Buyers for a home are restricted to people living in or near the community or people wanting to move into that particular area. In other words, the number of buyers for any particular house are limited considerably. Another point is that prices are affected by the terms and availability of financing. Many home building companies realized some years ago that they don't sell houses, they sell terms. They sell payments. So terms and availability of financing are the critical factor in the purchase and sale of many homes. People usually purchase the most expensive house they can afford the payments for. Lower interest rates lead to lower payments, lead to faster sales. Higher interest rates lead to higher payments, lead to slower sales. Because people can only get mortgages with payments that total 30 to 32% of their incomes. The value of a given property is often affected greatly by the zoning laws that apply to it. For instance, a couple of years ago we had a house that the zoning laws required to be set 30 feet back from the street. Unfortunately, the builder, through a miscalculation, had built it only 29 feet back from the street. And the city had put a restriction on the title that in effect gave them the right to ask us to tear the house down and move it back one full foot because it violated the zoning ordinance. Now, fortunately, we never had to do it, but if we'd had to do it, it could have been extremely expensive and it could have made us very, very unhappy with our purchase of that house. So check the zoning laws that apply to a particular piece of property before you purchase it. You have to know them intimately. Another point is that the value of any specific property is affected by the character of the neighborhood and the economic outlook for that neighborhood. So you have to look, what is the character of the neighborhood? Is it neat? Is it clean? Is it orderly? Is it dirty? All buildings are different. They may have hidden defects or exceptionally favorable features. In the Bible it says, judge not by appearances alone. And when you're looking at homes, you can never judge by appearances. It's very important that you look at the construction of a building, that you look at it very carefully. Sometimes you can buy a home that has a cracked foundation. Sometimes the home will be eaten up with termites and just painted over. Sometimes it will have a tremendous view, or sometimes it will have all kinds of possibilities. But remember, they're all different. They have to be inspected and approached differently. In every neighborhood, there may be periods of rapid turnover and periods of stagnation and decline, boom and bust. But stable is best. It's always best to invest in an area or a neighborhood that's stable. Property values may be affected by the quality of police and fire protection in the area. The areas that have low crime rates are more attractive than areas that have high crime rates. So look into police protection and fire protection. Find out what the crime rates are in the area. Many people sell to get out of an area because of crime rates. Many people will pay more to get into an area because of low crime rates. Property values are also affected by the availability of water, sewer, gas, electricity, and the costs of each of them. I've done a good deal of consulting work on property purchases, and I remember one where my client almost lost $2 million by buying a piece of property for which there was no water and no way to get water to the property. The vendors of the property, the sellers of the property, had hoped that my client would go ahead with the purchase and never check the water. But one of the things we checked into very carefully was the availability of water, and we found that there was no availability. I saved my client $250,000 down payment and $1.75 million in commitments by finding out about the water. Also, sewer, gas, electricity, and find out how much they cost. A final point with regard to this is that air, water, and noise pollution may have highly adverse effects on real estate value. For instance, being close to a freeway or being close to a heavily traveled roadway may generate an enormous amount of noise. My wife and I looked at a home not long ago, and we walked through the house. The house was beautiful. It was priced at about $75,000 to $100,000 below any home in that area of the same size and quality, and we thought, boy, this is a real buy, until we said, could we see the backyard? And the real estate agents, there were two of them, looked at each other, and they looked at each other, and their faces dropped, and they're obviously very disappointed. So we opened the back door into the backyard and got hit with a wall of noise, and it turned out there was a freeway just down the hill off the backyard, and the noise from the traffic was absolutely deafening. So it's very, very important that you check for noise pollution, that you check for smoke, you check the air, and you make very, very certain that it's a good place to locate. Does this begin to sound a little complicated? Remember, the only thing easy about money is losing it. Making money in anything is hard work and requires careful preparation plus eternal vigilance. The one who knows the most about what they're doing is the one who is likely to be the most successful. Everyone with a property for sale wants to get as much of your money for it as he or she possibly can. Just remember that. Any real estate investing you do must take the factors we've discussed into account, whether it's a single-family house or a high-rise apartment, a single-tenant store, or a high-rise office building. Wonderfully enough, however, if you're willing to do your homework and take your time, you can make prudent and profitable real estate purchases and sales. Here's the key rule for real estate investment. Write it down, brand it onto the outside of your checkbook. You make your profit when you buy real estate, not when you sell. Let me repeat that. You make your profit when you buy real estate, not when you sell. You make your profit by buying right. When you sell, you simply realize the profit that you made when you bought it properly. Many people lose money in real estate because they forget this vital law. They think that they're going to make money on the sale. No, you make money by purchasing it properly. Never forget this rule. Many inexperienced real estate speculators operate on what is called the greater fool theory when they buy a property. They convince themselves that no matter how bad or overpriced the property is, there will always be a greater fool along to take it off their hands at a higher price. That is a primary reason why people lose money in real estate. Another important rule is this. Don't become emotional about a property you are purchasing for investment, even a home. Always look at a property from the viewpoint of a critical purchaser. Ask yourself, who will buy this property from me and why? Now let's look at some of the factors affecting the choice of a neighborhood for you to invest in. First of all, in every city, growing or declining, there are areas that are also growing or declining. The patterns of growth and decline in a city are largely determined by the growth pattern of the city out from the central core. The growth pattern, in turn, is largely determined by the topography, or the existence of rivers, hills, valleys, oceans, and swamps, which channel the growth in different directions. The basic growth pattern of a city is what is called the expanding pie pattern. Imagine your city as a pie cut up into slices. As the city expands, the type of development in each slice tends to expand with it from the city core. If a slice starts as industrial, it will tend to continue to expand as industrial. If it starts as high-quality residential, the outer edges of the slice will continue expanding as high-quality residential. Gradually, however, a core or dying area will develop around the central business district as people, businesses, and commercial development expand toward the suburbs. Now, you can pick up real estate bargains in these declining areas, but remember, you are purchasing the future earning power of the property. In a way, you're buying a share in the stock of that neighborhood or area, and your first job is to determine that the neighborhood is holding or increasing in appeal and attractiveness as time passes. You don't want to buy a piece of property that's at a great price, but unfortunately it's going to be lower next year, and lower still the year after, and lower still the year after that. Here are the 10 factors to analyze in looking at any neighborhood. Number one, the location of the neighborhood with respect to other land uses. For instance, industry or commercial areas like shopping centers, or water like swamps and rivers, and with regard to the main lines of growth outward from the city center or core. You want to be close, but not too close to the major roadways and freeways. The second factor has to do with land use regulations, land use restrictions, and zoning, as we talked about earlier. Is it single-family zoning? Is it duplex zoning? Is it multiple-family zoning? Can you subdivide the property? Are you allowed to renovate or change the property in any way? It's very important that you know what the land use restrictions are. The third factor is the age of the neighborhood and the general condition of homes in the area. Remember, when you buy a house, you must buy it looking at it through the eyes of a person who is going to purchase it from you or rent it from you. What does the whole neighborhood look like? Is it improving in condition or is it declining in condition? A fourth factor is the types of people in the neighborhood, the demographics of the neighborhood, the age, the education, the occupations, the lifestyle. Is it a family neighborhood? Is it a single-person neighborhood? Is it a neighborhood with young people or old people? What kind of a neighborhood is it? The fifth factor is the types of buildings and other improvements in the area and their condition. Remember, you may purchase a home or renovate a home that looks terrific, but if it's next to a home that's collapsing, that is going to greatly affect your land value. The sixth factor is transportation corridors and facilities, in and out, access and egress. Is it easy or difficult to get into the neighborhood where you live? Is it easy to get onto the main roadways? Again, you want to be close, but not too close. The seventh factor is nearness to schools, churches, shopping centers, amusement places, and places and areas of employment. People with families like to live near schools, and they like to live near churches. We like to live near shopping centers, but not too close. We like to live near sources of recreation and amusement, especially parks and natural lands, close to these facilities, but we don't want to be too close. The eighth factor is the level of taxes and other burdens. Some areas have extremely high taxes that make them an undesirable area to live in, holding constant for all other factors. The ninth is utilities, conveniences, and services. Some areas don't have underground sewage. You have to have septic tanks. Some areas have above-ground electricity that makes the neighborhood unsightly. So look at the utilities, look at the conveniences and services. How often is garbage collected? Is it done by the city or is it private? The tenth factor is noise. As we said before, are there any special hazards or nuisances? Are there any dumps or landfills or any creek beds or railway tracks? Are there any freeways nearby? I heard this story a couple of years ago. Some friends bought this house, and the real estate agent called them up and told them about it, said he could only show them at 10 o'clock or 3 o'clock. And they said they couldn't see it at 10 o'clock or 3 o'clock that day. Could they see it the next day? And he said, yes, but only at 10 o'clock and 3 o'clock. And for some reason, the real estate agent would only show them at 10 o'clock and 3 o'clock. So they went, and they finally looked at the house at one of the two appointment times. They liked the house. It was beautiful. It was priced well. They were delighted with it. They purchased the house. They moved into the house, unpacked their furniture. And only then did they find that behind the backyard, in a gully, was a railway track. And there was a major Amtrak train that came roaring down that track every hour and a half. And the 10 o'clock and 3 o'clock appointments had been scheduled because it was well before and well after the train schedule. And as soon as they went to bed that night, that train went down and they came straight up in the air. But it was too late. They'd closed the deal and they owned the house. So be very careful. The surest way to evaluate a neighborhood is to walk through it and to get a feel for it. Look for evidence that homeowners are renovating and upgrading their properties. Listen for noise levels and look at pollution levels. Talk to the corner grocer, the person at the gas station, and especially the real estate agents with homes for sale. Learn everything you can just as though you were going to buy a house, move in, and live there for 20 years. Because the profitability of any home you buy will depend upon someone moving in for the long term. Once you've found a solid neighborhood that you have confidence in a solid city that has a strong, diversified economy, it's time to begin looking for a house to buy and fix up. This leads to my rule of 100, which is this. Expect to look at 100 houses before you are knowledgeable enough to make an offer on even one of them. Be patient. Do your homework. Don't rush. The time you take to look at your first 100 houses will pay you back over and over again in the months and years ahead. Shop carefully and look at everything available within the price range you're thinking about and outside the price range. Don't allow real estate agents to rush you by telling you that a house is priced below market and there are other buyers preparing to make offers if you don't act. Be patient until your research tells you that you found the right property for you. Spend as much time researching an investment as you spend earning the money for the investment. Let me repeat that. Always spend as much time researching the investment as you spend earning the money for the investment. The next thing to consider is the value to put on a piece of property. There are three methods to evaluate or appraise real estate, and in some way, you should know and take all three of these ways into consideration. The first way to evaluate real estate is called the market approach, which just means how much is it selling for per square foot compared to other properties of similar size, similar features, and similar location. You can just check by looking at the sales prices of other homes in the area. Remember, if a feature doesn't add to the value or if you can't sell the property for more because of it, don't pay extra for it, especially lot size or landscaping or paint or a pool. These are what are called hygiene factors versus motivators. A hygiene factor is something that if you don't have it, it's a demotivator and it depresses the value. But if you have it, it is not a motivator and it does not increase the value. Absence of a hygiene factor reduces value, but the presence does not increase the value. I've been out with real estate agents who point out the lot size and they say, well, it's a big lot, therefore the house is worth more. No, it's not worth any more because it's a big lot. It's simply a feature that doesn't add value, and it certainly doesn't add value when you come to reselling it. The second method of evaluating or appraising a house is called the cost approach, especially the replacement cost based on current cost of construction. How do you find out what costs are? Speak to builders. Speak to contractors. Find out how much it costs per square foot to build a home of a particular quality in a particular area. The third way to evaluate or appraise a home is called the income approach, and it's used for properties that generate income, and it's expressed as a rate of return on equity, or the amount you put up out of your own pocket, often called the return on cash invested, or ROI. To use the market approach, you simply compare sales prices, not listing prices, in the area in recent months on a per square foot basis. The simplest way of all, and I've used this for years, is just simply take the number of square feet in the house, divide it into the price to get the cost per square foot of the house. Now, there are many other things that go into the evaluation of a house, but that is usually, over time, your most accurate. To use the cost approach, you simply talk to home builders to find out how much it would cost to duplicate the same size and quality of building per square foot. To use the income approach, you do it this way. First, you add up all the expenses associated with owning a piece of property, including mortgage payments, taxes, and all other charges payable associated with ownership, like homeowners association, condominium fees, extra charges for garbage collection, and so on. And then you add the regular cost of maintenance, such as paint and carpeting, replacement of appliances, which takes place approximately every 7 years, and any upkeep expenses that the owner is responsible for. So you take all those together, then you deduct your total annual expenses from the income generated to get a net figure. You divide your equity investment into the net figure to get your rate of return. Now, if that sounds complicated, let me give you an example. In 1975, I purchased a condominium for $36,000, with $1,200 down and payments of $300 per month. Before it was completed, I rented it out initially at $275 a month. Now, that's below market, but it was to a solid tenant, so I was willing to absorb a $25 per month loss to have a solid tenant in the property from the time I took occupancy. After 6 months, I raised the rent to $300, and now I was breaking even. And by the end of the second year, I had the rent up to $350 per month. I raised the rent at the rate of $25 every 6 months. My out-of-pocket investment was $1,200, the down payment, plus $150 I had absorbed over 6 months when the rent was below the payments of $300 per month. Since all the expenses, including taxes and condominium fees, were being paid by the tenant by the second year, I was earning a net of $50 per month, $600 per year, on a total investment of $1,350. This worked out to a return on that condominium of 44% per annum. That was my return on cash invested. Now, you can see with those kind of returns possible in rental property, it doesn't take very long to start to build up a substantial estate. It's not very easy to get 44% per annum on a solid investment anywhere in the country. A rule of residential real estate is that over time, a residence should rent for 1% of its market value, or conversely, it will sell for 100 times its monthly rent. Let me repeat that again. It's very important when you're buying a home to rent out. A rule of residential real estate is that over time, a residence should rent for 1% of its market value, or conversely, it will sell for 100 times its monthly rent. Many people buy $150,000 and $200,000 homes in areas where the most rent that they can get is $800 to $1,000, and then they wonder why it is that they can't make a profit renting the property out to someone else. When you find a house that you decide is priced right because it has good potential to be upgraded and improved, you make an offer. The best deal for you is a small cash down payment with a first mortgage for 80 to 90% of the price and the seller agreeing to carry the balance over 5 to 7 years at an attractive rate of interest. A good strategy is to lowball at first, to offer about 70% of the asking price, even though most houses sell at between 80 and 90% of the asking price. Sometimes, for reasons you don't know, the seller will accept a ridiculously low offer, so always make a low offer to start off with. You can always come up. Take your time in negotiating a purchase. Your patience can save you hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars. Never allow yourself to be rushed in buying a piece of real estate. Once you've purchased the house and taken possession, you want to fix it up as quickly as possible, putting your money where it goes the furthest in raising the rental or resale value of the house. These are the key places to invest in renovating and upgrading. One, top of the list, is good quality paint. Using designer colors like white or off-white or powder blue or cream or beige or peach. A designer color is one that's acceptable to almost everyone. Your increase will be as much as $5 in additional value for every $1 you spend on paint. Let me repeat that. For every $1 you spend in painting a house when you're fixing it up, it increases the value by as much as $5. It's a terrific place to invest. A second place to invest in upgrading and renovating a house or an apartment is in carpets. You always put better quality carpets in high traffic areas and cheaper carpets in bedrooms, dens, and basements, and it will increase your value by as much as $4 for every $1 of carpet. But it's very important that you do two things. First of all, use neutral tones, beiges, powder blue, creams, whites, colors that go with anybody's furniture. And second, that you use one color throughout the entire house or apartment. The third place where you can put money is in landscaping. Clean up the outside completely so it makes a good first impression. Remember, look at this house through the eyes of a purchaser. You want to have what is called curb appeal. When the purchaser pulls up to the house, the first thing they do when they see the house is they say, "Wow, that looks attractive." You can get a payoff of as much as $25 for every dollar that you put into cleaning up the yard. In other words, if you spend $1,000 to landscape the front and clean it up so it's attractive, it can increase the curb appeal, the value of the house, by as much as $25,000. Remember, when a person is buying a house, one of the things they're thinking is, what will my friends, what will my family see when they drive up to this house? And if they think that their family and friends will be impressed when they see this house, they're much more likely to pay the kind of price that you want to get from it. A fourth place to invest in fixing up a house is in fireplaces. According to real estate appraisers, fireplaces add $1.23 in value for every dollar you spend. That means you get a 23% increase in value for every dollar that you put in. So it's a good investment. Even if you just put in a false gas fireplace, it still increases the value in excess of the amount of money you spend, which is to say you'll get it all out and more when you sell the house. A fifth thing that you can do in renovating is to add a full bathroom. This increases the value by $1.10 for every dollar that you spend. A sixth thing you can do is put new siding on the outside. This increases the value dollar for dollar. For every dollar that you put into new siding, you'll get a dollar out when you sell. A minor kitchen remodel is the seventh thing that you can do. New appliances, paint, and wallpaper will give you back 90 cents in added value for every dollar you spend. A major kitchen remodel, by the way, will give you 89 cents back for every dollar you spend. Not a great investment, but sometimes you need to invest in the kitchen to enhance and protect your investment in the rest of the house. Everything else that you might do to a house adds less than 90 cents per dollar that you spend, sometimes much less. For instance, new roofing adds only 80 cents in value for every dollar you spend. Skylights add only 75 cents in value for every dollar you spend. Adding a wood deck adds only 72 cents in value. Remodeling a bathroom adds only 75 cents. Installing a swimming pool only adds 32 cents for every dollar you spend on the pool. In fact, many houses are considered less attractive because of the upkeep and maintenance required with a swimming pool. So don't put in a swimming pool with the thought that you're going to increase the value. Of course, if there is repair work to be done on plumbing, electrical, or carpentry, you'll have to do these too. You should do a detailed calculation of how much you will have to spend to renovate before you make an offer on the house. Use your list of needed repairs and their cost to get the seller to come down in price. The better prepared you are, the more likely you are to drive a good bargain. Remember, you make your profit by buying right, and you realize your profit by selling right. Once you've completed the facelift on the house inside and out, you are now ready to refinance, sell, or rent out and move on to the next project. Financial success in real estate basically comes from leverage, which is the use of borrowed money to multiply your return on your equity. This is often called using OPM, other people's money. And real success comes from super leverage, which is based on five keys. Here they are. Number one is a low price relative to the market. The lower a price you can get relative to what the market will pay for it, the more money you can make on your investment. Number two is good terms. Sometimes terms are as important or more important than the price. You can pay more if you can get better terms. It usually means, though, a low interest rate and low payment. Many people say the key to real estate is location, location, location. But the key to success in real estate investment is terms, terms, terms. Number three for super leverage is the vendor or the seller taking back a second mortgage. So you have little or no cash of your own in the investment. Remember, if you only pay $1,000 down on a $100,000 house and you can sell the house for $105,000 and make $5,000 on your investment, that's a 500% return in whatever period of time we're talking about. That is called super leverage. Now, the fourth key to super leverage is fast and aggressive upgrading of the property. Remember, time is valuable. Time is money. The faster you turn the property over, the higher will be your return on your investment. And the fifth key is refinancing and cashing out, which means getting your money back and owning the property with no investment. Let me give you an example of refinancing and cashing out. Let us say you buy a $100,000 house and you pay $20,000 down and get an $80,000 first mortgage. And then you upgrade, renovate, refurbish the house, and rent it out for, let us say, $1,200 a month. If you get an independent appraisal, an appraiser will probably put a value of 100 times the rental rate on the house, or $120,000. You can then go back to a finance company or a trust company and refinance and get a new mortgage for $100,000, pay out the old mortgage, pay back the $20,000 that you put in as a down payment, and now you own the house, $120,000 house, you owe it free and clear, you have all your money out of it, and the tenant will then go on to pay off the payments. This is called super leverage, where you finance out and end up owning the house with none of your own money left in it. Everything you've just learned, everything we've just talked about with regard to buying one house as an investment is true for a duplex, a triplex, a fourplex, or an apartment building of any size. The only difference is the scale. The only limiting factors are your imagination and your resources. That's why it's better to start small and grow one step at a time, expanding your imagination and your vision of what's possible, and more important, increasing your knowledge and experience. If you start with a single house, the first house will be more difficult than any other project you've ever engaged in. The second house won't be quite as difficult. The third house will be much easier. By the time you've done this 10 times, and it may take several years to do it 10 times, you'll be an expert. The formula for buying apartments is simple. You purchase the income-producing property with a low down payment. You upgrade the property by renovating and refurbishing with paints and carpets. You raise the rents and reduce the expenses to increase the net cash flow. Then you use the additional cash flow to refinance and get a bigger mortgage. You remortgage the apartment, take your money out of the project to invest in another property, and do it all over again. Now, this may take 3 to 5 years with an apartment building if you buy it properly, if you buy it in the right city, if you buy it under the right terms and conditions. But many people who own hundreds or thousands of apartments own them free and clear, and they have all their cash out, and they have had for years. The key is to search for properties that have the potential to be upgraded in value by improving the properties and raising the rents. Put another way, look for properties where the rents are low relative to the market and the neighborhood. This requires a lot of research, therefore the law of 100. Look at 100 properties before you make an offer on the first one. Even if you find an outstanding property the second one you look at, look at 100. Discipline yourself to carefully examine 100 properties before you make your first offer. That will pay you back in thousands and thousands of dollars of increased income or savings. How do you find income-producing properties? There are several sources that you can use, very simply. First of all, read the ads in the newspapers and in the smaller neighborhood papers. Anyone who has a property for sale advertises it in the paper. But remember, most of the properties that are advertised in the paper are overpriced. There's something wrong with them. Nobody sells a piece of property that is generating a reasonably high return with a low level of trouble and inconvenience. The second source is drive through the neighborhood that you're interested in and take down the phone numbers on every house for sale. Contact every realtor who works in the area and tell them exactly what you're looking for. You can also run your own ads asking for income-producing properties. Have business cards printed with the title Real Estate Investor on them and give one to everybody you talk to. Tell them that you're looking for income-producing properties and you have money to spend on them. Now, how do you evaluate an apartment building? Well, there's several things that you can do. Number one is compare the building on the basis of what is called cost per unit or cost per apartment compared with other buildings of the same size and condition. Use the construction cost method. Speak to a builder and find how much it would cost to build this kind of an apartment. Use the market comparison method. Find out what apartments of this size and condition have been selling for in the past. And use the cost per square foot method. How much are they selling for per square foot of rentable space, which means the space inside the walls of the apartment? The second way to evaluate an apartment building is to inspect every single unit in the building. This is terribly important. Before you make an offer, go through every single unit with a clipboard and inspect it in detail and make notes on every single apartment so that you can describe it back to yourself or to someone else later. In apartments, most major appliances have to be replaced approximately every 7 years. Ask how old are the appliances. Sometimes they will sell a building that's 7 years old, and a year later you'll have to put in $50,000 for new appliances, and it will completely ruin the property as an investment for several years. Number three is compare the expenses of operation of an apartment building before debt service or before mortgage payments. Here's the basic rule. If the tenants pay for the utilities, the gas and electricity and water, the total expenses for running the apartment building should be 30% of the gross rents. If the landlord pays all the utilities, the total expenses should be approximately 40% of gross rents. For instance, if the annual rentals were $100,000, let us say you had 10 apartments and they paid $10,000 a year each in rent, and you had total gross rentals of $100,000, then if the tenants pay for the utilities, the total expenses should be not more than $30,000. If the landlord pays utilities, then including that, the total expenses should be not more than $40,000. If either of these figures are out in any way, it means that expenses could be understated or there's a potential to reduce expenses and increase cash flow. In other words, it may signal that it's a good business opportunity if the expenses of running the apartments are higher than they should be relative to those figures I just gave you. There are two types of bargains in real estate. There's the obvious bargain, which people snap up right away, and there's what is called the sleeper. The sleeper requires three things in order to increase its value. Number one, it requires some creative upgrading, some cosmetic alterations, some paint, carpets, landscaping, and so on, so it looks better. Number two, the sleeper requires changes in use. For instance, sometimes you can put offices or retail stores downstairs on the ground floor in apartments and dramatically increase the rent that you can charge for the space. And the third thing that a sleeper requires, and most important is better management techniques, techniques that enable you to reduce the expenses and increase the rents. Everything that you can do that makes you a better manager, that enables you to increase rents or reduce expenses, dramatically increases your return on your investment. Always find out why the purchaser is selling. Get all the information possible about the seller's situation before you make an offer. Remember, in any business, cash is king. It's not the only thing, it's everything. Always think in terms of safeguarding your cash, parting with it slowly, grudgingly, carefully, and not at all if possible. Make every offer to purchase income-producing property subject to verification of all revenues and expenses. Especially ask for bank deposit books to get an accurate account of income. If the seller of the property will not freely give you all the financial information you require, walk away from the deal as fast as you can go. Whenever a seller of property is reluctant to give you previous financial results from the building, it means that there's something wrong with it. When bargaining with the seller, use all the building shortcomings and defects to justify a low offer, but be polite, courteous, and low-key. Don't reveal your strategy to anyone, not even the real estate agent. Keep it to yourself, confidential, and insist on meeting the seller of the property personally. Don't ever buy with a real estate agent in between you. There's too much opportunity for miscommunication. Have an engineer check all the main plumbing, boilers, furnaces, and wiring before you finalize a deal. Have a builder check the structure for soundness. Have an exterminator check for termites or pests of any kind. Here are some pitfalls to avoid and problems to deal with in owning rental properties. The number one biggest single problem in owning rental properties is bad tenants. Your investment is only as sound as the willingness and the ability of your tenants to pay rent. If you don't pay close attention to this, this is where you'll make your biggest mistakes in owning rental property. Every bad tenant who defaults on their rent costs you net income because the expenses go on regardless. Now here's the second pitfall to avoid. High vacancy rates or seasonal fluctuations can really hurt your income, can even cause you to lose a building. If you've done all the research and analysis I talked about earlier, though, you won't get caught. A good friend of mine came down from the Northeast to Phoenix one winter and bought an apartment building that was very reasonably priced based on his experience. Only in March and April, most of the tenants, 70-80% of them, moved out. And when he came back, he was losing an enormous amount of money. When he came back and found out they had all been rented on short 6-month leases to people from the North who came down to Phoenix in the wintertime. So because of the seasonal fluctuation, suddenly he had an empty apartment building, and he wasn't the only one. A lot of property owners were stuck with empty apartment buildings, and he almost lost his shirt. Commercial real estate and real estate development follow along the same lines of analysis. Just remember that you are buying the long-term future earning power of a piece of property, and you must analyze each property carefully by asking these questions. How much does it cost me? How much do I get back? When can I get my return on my money? How certain is it that the return will materialize? And here's the key question, what else can I do with the same money? I've deliberately not talked about such things as equity buildup, depreciation or amortization rates, the impact of taxes or discounted cash flow rates. What we've talked about here are the basics that you need to know to get started. There are many books, courses, and seminars on the subject, and I recommend that you get them and read them. As in any business, real estate investment requires an enormous amount of time, energy, dedication, courage, and persistence. Not only that, you must really enjoy it if you're going to succeed at it. You must be willing to put your head down for several years, work hard, wrestle with unruly bankers and sellers, negotiate, grind, compromise continually, and fight with difficult tenants who feel that all landlords are fair game. However, if you persevere in spite of these challenges, one day you could wake up with a substantial portfolio of income-producing properties, a healthy cash flow, and financial independence for life.